Welcome to the National Kidney Foundation's Life as a Nephrology Professional podcast, where we explore research and innovation in kidney healthcare. I'm your host, Sam Kent. I do want to thank our episode sponsor, Ardelyx, for their support of part two of our team discussion, hyperphosphatemia. Today, we pick up from the last episode, where we covered the current landscape of hyperphosphatemia, drawing from clinician and patient experiences. The current episode will take a deep dive into physiology regarding phosphate absorption and how this knowledge has led to development of the phosphate absorption inhibitor, tenapanor. I'm joined today by our panelists from part one of this hyperphosphatemia conversation. I'd like to ask our panelists to introduce themselves once more.
Hi, so again, my name is Alex Leitner. I am a nephrologist and again, an assistant professor of medicine at Northwestern University in Chicago. Been in Chicago now for 10 years, completed my residency fellowship and postdoctoral fellowship here in artificial intelligence. I have an interest in early detection of kidney disease through AI mechanisms, imaging, and patient charting, as well as working with Dr. Tamara Isakova on impacts of mineral bone disease on cardiovascular health.
Hello, my name is Anabel Viruete, and I'm a registered dietitian and an assistant professor in the Department of Nutrition Science at Purdue University. And I've been a renal nutrition scientist for about 12 years now. I focus on lifestyle interventions and pharmacological interventions in several outcomes, including chronic kidney disease, mineral and bone disorder, the gastrointestinal tract, and also a secondary line of research in health disparities in the Hispanic Latinx population with chronic kidney disease. And happy to be back. Thanks.
Hello, everybody. My name is Alex Berrios. I am a kidney patient, 44 years old. I reside in Louisville, Kentucky. Looking forward to some more conversation on this. Thank you very much. Looking forward to having this discussion.
Well, thank you for being back, everyone. I'll start with Alex. So in the first part, we discussed about what phosphate levels we should be targeting and, you know, how phosphate is being managed. But I think we'll take a deeper dive today, as I mentioned, into, you know, pathophysiology. And I think it's also so important to know how phosphate or phosphorus gets absorbed. Could you give us some insight and take us back to all the processes?
Yeah, sure. I think this is probably the first time I've explained this without a cellular diagram in front of me, but I'll do my best. So again, the majority of phosphorus is absorbed in the small intestine. There's kind of two big mechanisms for phosphorus absorption. There's paracellular absorption through clotting channels. This is a high throughput mechanism that happens along concentration gradients of phosphorus. The positive charge in the lumen pushes it through the claudins, and you know, the more phosphorus is in the lumen, the higher, you know, the faster this can be pushed through. If there's a lot of phosphorus in the gut, this mechanism is going to be used a lot. The other mechanism is sort of active in transcellular transport through sodium-dependent phosphate channel NAPI2B. This is a more specific channel for phosphorus that uses energy to absorb sodium and phosphorus together. And we know that in low phosphate concentrations in the gut, this channel can actually be upregulated to kind of pick up what little phosphate remains there. So, you're eating a diet really low in phosphorus or you bound up all your phosphorus, this channel can pick up some extra phosphorus that would have, you know, been missed. And the other end of phosphorus, homeostasis is, of course, the kidney, where people urinate out the rest of their phosphorus. But in dialysis patients, that becomes a big issue because, you know, one of your big compensatory mechanisms is not reabsorbing phosphorus in the urine through inhibiting NAPI to A and C channels. Without those mechanisms, people start to build up phosphorus in ESRD, and that's why we start to get these problems that we're discussing.
So this brings us to an important question. What is the mechanism of action of tenapanor, and how is it different from that of phosphate binders?
Yeah, so first, you know, and more simply, phosphate binders bind phosphate in the gut. And so they, you know, physically complex with phosphate and make them into a non-absorbable compound. They have to be taken with the phosphate that you want to bind and in a large enough dose to bind phosphate. You can't just take a little bit of phosphate binder and expect it to bind more phosphate than it could actually compound with. So it's kind of a, you know, one-to-one sort of thing. Tenapanor is a little bit different because it actually works to, as a mechanism to inhibit the gut from absorbing phosphorus, you know, overall, you know, irregardless of kind of the amount there. And so what tenapanor does is it blocks a sodium hydrogen exchanger, you know, type 3 in the intestinal cell, which in vitro, we it's believed that that results in proton retention in the cell, and that proton retention in the cell leads to deformation of those claudins in the paracellular pathway. That sort of deformation of those claudins limits their ability to uptake phosphorus through the paracellular mechanism. So it can, you know, knock out one pathway of your phosphorus absorption in your gut kind of just by taking, a pill twice a day. The other part about blocking this sodium hydrogen exchanger is that there's more sodium in the intestinal space than before. Sodium pulls water, which is kind of how we practice nephrology. And, you know, that leads to more water, which leads to more stool mass, which is also part of the mechanism. And I think why this, if I'm correct, is used in IBD as well to create more regular bowel movements.
So how are patient education and treatment considerations different for tenapanor as opposed to phosphate binders then?
Being forthcoming, this is a newer drug. So we kind of pooled our experience as an institution here at Northwestern with the medication. As you know, any drug takes, 10 to 20 years from going to FDA approval to sort of regular practice. But we do have a couple patients on tenapanor here. And I think, Mr. Mariosa is going to tell us a little bit about being on tenapanor later. And, we can see if his, experiences line up with our own. But again, it was approved last year by the FDA as an add-on therapy for hyperphosphatemia, which an add-on therapy from the FDA means it can be used in patients that either haven't had correct, good enough phosphorus control with dietary counseling and phosphate binders, or in patients that can't take phosphate binders, can't tolerate phosphate binders don't work for whichever reason. Again, it's usually a twice daily dosage. Its mechanism of action, it can be taken as a regular schedule. You can take it with your other pills, one in the morning, one in the evening. The timing compared to snacks and food is not as important. The pills are, just a normal standard size pill without having to take multiple of them. Around 50% of patients, the biggest counseling you have to give patients is around 50% of patients in, these trials of taking tenapanor for a year report diarrhea. And what that means is on average having an extra bowel movement every 2.5 days. Most of this is tolerable and doesn't really even require any sort of change. But about 15% do have severe diarrhea. The diarrhea from tenapanor is reversible and you can respond either to cessation of the medicine or titration of the dose. So it's just important to counsel patients really to report what's happening with their bowel movement. You don't want to, give somebody some, large dehydration from diarrhea or just feeling bad because they're, replacing, taking phosphate binders with, being on the toilet. I mean, that can be a big concern, but for the large majority of people, you can, work a dose of the medicine. But again, it is a newer medicine. We are starting to use it. I know we'll keep looking for other side effects, but I think it's been used, enough in these trials and no really other significant patient counseling thing has really come up other than that one side effect to really counsel people.
I think speaking about patient counseling, I think a team approach is so important as we go forward and trying to manage hyperphosphatemia. I'll turn to Annabelle now. I think we recognize that despite best efforts with, diet dialysis and phosphate binders, many, patients on dialysis continue to have trouble meeting goals. Why is that?
Yeah, it's something that Alex already also mentioned. But if we think about it, a lot of our patients don't have residual kidney function, so they are not able to excrete that extra phosphorus in urine in order to maintain the concentrations of phosphorus within the normal range. And therefore, the amount of phosphorus that goes into our bodies and that one that is absorbed by the intestines becomes really the focus on our phosphorus management now. And this includes mostly the amount of phosphorus that a patient eats and up to a few months ago, the amount that a phosphate binder can bind, which even after dialysis is likely not enough. If we think about these medications are not perfect and they bind a set amount of phosphorus that is not enough compared to what usually a person, normal person and a patient on dialysis consumes. That can be up to 1500 milligrams, which is even double the recommended daily allowance for healthy people. So in terms of phosphorus coming from diet, there's been really this paradigm shift from restricting, and I talked about it in the first episode, from restricting all of the foods that were rich in phosphorus, regardless of the source. So for example, we restricted a lot of animal-based products, but also some plant-based products that have a lot of other nutrients that are beneficial, including beans, nuts, whole grains, because of that content of phosphorus. And what we do now, after some research that showed that different sources of phosphorus coming from different foods can have different bioaccessibility, meaning that this ability of the intestines to absorb that phosphorus, or the phosphorus that is available for absorption. So this new focus classifies phosphorus in organic sources of phosphorus and inorganic sources of phosphorus. So organic primarily are those plant-based foods and animal-based foods, and the inorganic sources of phosphorus are those that I was mentioning that are added to foods and this phosphate-containing additives for different reasons, including taste, increased shelf life, color for the product, etc. So within the organic phosphorus, the amount of phosphorus available for absorption in plant-based foods is less than animal foods, and that is because the phosphorus is mostly bound to phytate, and our intestines, at least our small intestine, does not have that enzyme needed for the phosphorus to be released from the phytate in order to be available for absorption. So in general, there are other things that actually can impact that phosphorus bound to phytate, including cooking, sprouting. So for example, grain sprouting enhances the content of phosphorus that is available for absorption, and also fermenting foods, which are more popular now. So in general, these plant-based foods are absorbed, or the bioaccessibility is about 20 to 40%. Next, the animal-based products are in meat, poultry, fish, dairy products, and these phosphorus is more efficiently absorbed to about 60 to 80%, so compared to the plant-based foods, which is 20 to 40%, depending. And finally, these inorganic sources of phosphorus that contain the phosphorus additives, this availability of or bioaccessibility, so this phosphorus that it's available for absorption, has been reported as up to 100%, but there's really a lot more research that has to be done in order for us to know exactly what amount of phosphorus is absorbed. So as I mentioned also in episode one, we now focus more on educating patients on sources of phosphorus instead of just telling patients to restrict all sources of phosphorus. However, as I mentioned, sometimes dialysis, limiting dietary phosphorus through the foods that patients consume, and the use of phosphate binders are not enough. So it's really nice now having an additional therapy that can help us or patients limit the amount of phosphorus that is absorbed. So it's definitely a welcome tool in our toolbox.
You know, I note that recommendations have changed quite a bit over the past few years, but I think we're in a phase of medicine where, you know, we're trying to individualize recommendations. What is your take on individualized medicine when it comes to hyperphosphatemia?
So I think it is really, I'm more of a patient-centered approach. So that patient-centered approach is definitely an individual approach. And that, as a dietitian, is what we are trained on. It is really centered on the assessment that we do in our patients. And I mentioned also in episode one, so I cannot just restrict phosphorus-containing additives to a patient if that person is not consuming any phosphate-containing foods. So in that case, really targeting to the person, the circumstances that person is in. So integrating foods, but also, for example, meal timing and the different types of medications that they may be consuming. So just trying to target all of those things in order to best treatment for that patient.
Thank you, Annabelle. And, you know, we've discussed that, you know, again, patient experience is such an important thing. So I'm going to turn to Mr. Berrios. I understand that you've been on tenapanor for about 60 days. Can you share your experience?
Yeah, my experience with tenapanor has been a lot better than being on the phosphorus binders by far, because it was very easy to be able to take it morning and night and not have to think about the in-between snacks. So that's been very helpful to know that having to simply a pill in the morning with my breakfast and a pill in the evening at dinner make things a lot easier for me to not, you know, have to always remember and have to set a timer for when to take those binders, because the phosphorus binders were always hard to forget to take at a snack or bring it with you when you're at a social place.
We do recognize that this current experience may not be representative of others. And of course, as we know, every patient responds to medications in different ways. I think it's important to be conscious that tenapanor is indicated as an add-on therapy in patients who have had an inadequate response to phosphate binders, who are intolerant of any dose of phosphate binder therapy.
Are there other questions or issues you've heard from individuals on dialysis about hyperphosphatemia that you'd like to share?
Yes. When I've talked to patients and I've talked to clinicians about high phosphorus, a lot of times the patient would tell me that they just didn't have a lot of education on what the phosphorus was doing. And we've alluded to this already in our conversation, both in the first part and in this second part today. But I really think that something that I've observed as a patient sitting in the chair, that there are a lot of times patients just don't know what the phosphorus is doing and why they have to take the binder. They're just given this medication and then that's kind of it. And that's unfortunate that there's not really any education on the reasons why they need to take the phosphorus binders and why, and why the tenapanor can be helpful as well.
All right. So as we come towards the end of part two and concluding the series, I'd like to go around the table and ask from some thoughts and lessons learned from this whole experience for our panelists. So I'd like to start off with Annabelle. So Annabelle, what is your biggest takeaway going forward, having learned, you know, a multi-pronged approach and hearing from the other two panelists as well?
Yeah, one is that the control of hyperphosphatemia is really complex, and there's been a lot of lessons learned along the time. Luckily, research is evolving nicely, and it has allowed us to focus on different things for the management of phosphorus. And in my end, there's been definitely a lot of evolution in the last 15 years. When I was a dietetic student, I learned about restricting everything. And luckily now, as a researcher, there's definitely welcome research that has shown that food matters and the food source matters in terms of the amount of phosphorus. And at the end of the day, we really have to individualize it to the patient and hope for the best phosphorus management outcomes and quality of life of the patient.
Mr. Berrios.
Yeah, thank you, Sam. My takeaway from this is, one, as a patient, learning and hearing all these, you know, the kind of background behind why we have the phosphorus and the binders, it's really important. And I think that's something that me as a patient am always interested to learn more about that. And I wish I had that opportunity to learn it while I was in the clinic in the chair. And that's just unfortunate. I know, due to constraints and things, you can't just kind of have that kind of conversation. But, you know, if I could wish, I would love that. That'd be great. But again, another takeaway I'd love is just the innovation and the technology of the fact that, like, medicine and therapeutics have come a long way. And to know that there's now medications like tenapanor out on the market that will make my life easier, and being able to control this high phosphorus. It's good to see that there's innovation, and excited to see where things will be even in 10 more years from now as well.
And lastly, Alex.
Yeah, I think, you know, a couple takeaways here. I think my biggest takeaway is that, you know, maybe we're not doing enough to educate our patients on phosphorus early enough. And maybe that doesn't mean, you know, restricting their diet or even modifying their diet, but at least teaching them what it is and that it's coming when they get diagnosed with chronic kidney disease, that identifying sources of phosphorus in their diet, you know, identifying good eating habits, again, even if they don't have to make those changes quite yet, you know, it's important to start thinking about that way when the changes become more important and start actually elevating people's phosphorus, we can, you know, make them more quickly and with more, you know, buy-in without people just saying, well, why are you showing me this red number? I don't feel anything, or, you know, it doesn't affect me today. So why can't we just do my treatment and get me home? You know, and you've already said this to me. So maybe, again, emphasizing some of the more important things about why we do what we do, and that we're really, I guess, just all here, part of a team, just trying to help each other, you know, do well on as patients and as their patients' physicians.
Well, thank you, everyone. We couldn't thank you enough for taking the time to share your insight today. And I think the listeners are really going to benefit from this. To the listeners, thank you for tuning in to the Life of the Nephrology Professional podcast, where we explore best practices and strive to foster a sense of camaraderie among the kidney health community. We do hope that you found this two-part hyperphosphatemia episode series educational and insightful to your practice. We look forward to seeing you for our next episode. Until next time, may your practice be innovative and your research be groundbreaking. Thank you.